represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Interfacing complete. Please stand by. Now downloading Tech Talk Radio with Dr. Richard Schertz and Jim Russ. Tech Talk Radio, it's technology you can understand. And now, here are Dr. Richard Schertz and Jim Russ.
Welcome to Tech Talk Radio. We are in the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University talking technology. I'm Dr. Richard Schertz.
And I'm Jim Russ.
It's been a huge week this week with all the Boston Marathon news.
Yeah, really.
And we will be able to talk today somewhat about the technology that was applied during the investigation and the capture of the two perpetrators of that particular bombing.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of an interesting thing to look at what was available. We're going to be featuring this week the father of information theory. I actually covered him back in March of 2007, but I thought I should revisit him again.
Mm-hmm.
This Claude Shannon was suggested by Bob in Maryland,
yes.
One of our loyal listeners.
Bob is becoming an unpaid member of the staff
Yes, he certainly is. The Digital Public Library, a massive digital public library, was released this week, and it's available to review. That'll be the website of the week. And there was an article released this week that Wi-Fi routers are quite easy to hack. It's a little troubling, so
mm-hmm.
I'll say what you can do to protect yourself. There's not too much you can do, but there are some things you can do to protect yourself against that. And, of course, I'll talk a little bit, if I have time, about geocaching. It's kind of a new hobby. Looking for stuff using GPS.
That's interesting.
It's kind of an interesting thing. It's been around for a while, but now that everybody's got GPS in their phones, everybody can become a little geocacher. And, of course, it was a huge, huge mailbag.
Indeed.
There's a letter in your mailbox.
Oh, yeah. We got an email from Jim right across from the control board here.
Who would that be?
I don't know. Dear Doc, in light of the events in Boston this week, I have a few questions as to how technology, social media play a role in police work. There were cameras everywhere. What's involved in wiring a metropolitan area with surveillance cameras? How costly is it? How can the images of potential suspects be captured by these cameras and used by federal and state authorities? Oh, boy, this is a lot of questions. How do authorities track cell phone calls to the 911 center if the number is placing the call isn't captured? How do you feel about the role of social media in all of this? About the broadcast of radio transmission from the crime scene by the police and the firecast. Thanks, signed, your ever curious sidekick on the other side of the control panel. Well, there was quite a bit of technology that was used this week, and I'll kind of run down the kind of technology that we had available. Probably the number one technology that was of use was, of course, the surveillance cameras. And Boston does have metropolitan surveillance cameras, but it turns out that the surveillance camera of interest was on the Lord & Taylor's store. It
mm-hmm.
was their surveillance camera. It was a dome surveillance camera, and it produced high-definition video. It was a top-down view. And they actually showed one of the suspects dropping the backpack that was actually the bomb. But that particular camera did not have a great angle on his face. So it turned out that there was a guy, David Green, who took a picture of the explosion immediately after the bomb went off.
Mm-hmm.
And it turned out, and David Green sent in this cell phone picture to the police, and it turned out that that cell phone picture had the best image of suspect number two, his facial image. It was just from a snap from a cell phone. And so the police were able to use the surveillance camera to decide who did the hit. But the great facial pictures were coming from cell phone cameras that were taken there up close. The other thing, a piece of technology that was used a lot this week was how do they dispose of potential bombs? And they had the Explosive Ordnance Disposal Team, and that team used Telerob, which was an explosive ordnance disposal device. It features a six-axis manipulator that can extend out over 9 feet. It has a pair of cameras and enough diffusing tools to neutralize most any threat. So they were able to take these little robots up there and then remotely defuse the bombs without putting any particular person at risk. Another technology that was really useful right at the end, when the one suspect was hiding in the boat, helicopters flew overhead with infrared cameras, and they could see the heat. That's called forward-looking infrared. You know where that came from? It used to be a long... Let's have an aside.
Oh, let's have an aside.
Of course. Why would they say forward-looking? Of course, a camera's always going to be forward-looking. It seems kind of ridiculous.
Sure.
It turned out in the old days, they used to use long-range sensors from airplanes with radar. And in radar, since it has a Doppler shift, they would have to use side-looking radar in order to get a good image rather than forward-looking radar. So they had side-looking radar. And there was a big breakthrough when they put infrared cameras on these aircraft, and they could look forward. So to make a big deal out of it, they call it forward-looking infrared, or FLIR. That goes back to the old military days.
No kidding.
I mean, the whole idea of a camera being forward-looking...
You would just
expect that. So sorry for that aside. Yeah, a FLIR. And FLIR's infrareds pick up black body radiation. See, we'll have another aside here.
Okay.
Because I did research in this for so many years.
The aside count now to two for this week's show.
And so it turns out these infrared cameras actually detect black body radiation. That's thermal radiation, which is actually emitted by the body. They don't see reflected light. And whenever any object has a temperature to it, you know, molecules vibrate and it generates radiation. The peak of the black body curve is around 8 to 12 microns. That's the wavelength, 8 to 12 microns wavelength. That's far infrared. And then they've got near infrared band around 3 to 5 microns. Those are two atmospheric transmission windows. So they didn't say whether this was a 3 to 5 micron FLIR or an 8 to 12. I didn't see that.
Mm-hmm.
Chances are it was an 8 to 12. Just for reference, the visible band is about half a micron.
Mm-hmm.
So half a micron wavelength is visible. 3 to 5 is the first infrared band. 8 to 12 is the second infrared band. So they could actually see heat. So you can actually look at the person, because the canvas then is cold. You look right through the canvas and you see the person underneath the canvas. So they can look right through that. And the last technology that they deployed is actually a technology that was developed by the military, flashbangs.
What
they did, flashbangs, they were developed in the 60s,
uh-huh.
And these are sort of like stun devices. These are grenades that are designed to stun their target with very, very loud noise and very, very bright light. While they don't cause serious injury, they do blind the target for up to 5 seconds and cause temporary loss of both hearing and balance. So when they went in there and made the initial assault on this particular suspect in the boat, that's what all the explosions were. Those were flashbangs going off that were set off by the police. And then that more or less disoriented him. So after those flashbangs went off, they didn't really hear much of anything from them.
Be interesting, because apparently he was already bleeding from having been shot overnight.
He was bleeding. Yeah.
I wonder how much longer he had before, you know, if they hadn't found him.
No, I don't know. I think he was in bad shape, and so I was very lucky that it came down the way. Now you mentioned social media in your question. Turns out social media was used a lot. The police had a Twitter account.
Yeah.
And they would Twitter out results. The police were also, for some reason, transmitting their transmissions in unencrypted bands, and so people could just sit in on and listen to the police transmissions. And I guess they assumed that the one suspect wouldn't have a radio. But I'm thinking, I don't know why they don't use encrypted bands for that, actually.
See, the thing is, most police departments do, but the thing of it is, these days, and I have it on my iPhone, there are apps out there where people are, you can get encrypted radios to listen to police communication. They're expensive.
Mm-hmm.
Some departments use radios where you have to have a specific machine to hear it.
Yeah.
Others, you can hear it on the old style police scanner.
Mm-hmm.
But there are organizations that are set up that just simply refeed, rebroadcast police transmissions that you can get for free on your iPhone.
On your iPhone. So probably that's what people,
that's probably what people are listening to.
They're probably listening on their iPhone standing in the crowd.
But the way 800 communications work, they're able to move these communications to channels that are discreet and that are where people can't listen to them. So, but there were so many agencies involved in this thing, it's unclear how... You know, the
communications unfolded.
Right. Yeah.
Now, the biggest impact of social media, though, was in raising funds for the victims.
Really?
It was actually quite amazing.
Huh.
Crowdfunding actually turned out to be enormous. Like, there was one crowdfunding site, Bucks for Bauman. This was a GoFundMe site. This is a site for crowdfunding. GoFundMe. It raised more than $192,000 in 2 days for Jeff Bauman, the 27-year-old marathon spectator who lost both legs.
Mm-hmm.
Another GoFundMe site was for Celeste and Sydney. They were the married couple. It was for their recovery fund. It raised more than $396,000 of its $500,000 goal to aid Celeste Corcoran and a teenage daughter, Sydney. Oh, yeah. No, this isn't the married couple. This is Celeste Corcoran and teenage daughter, Sydney. Celeste lost both legs in the bombing, and Sydney suffered severe shrapnel injuries to one of her legs. There was a couple of newlyweds there, Patrick Down and Jessica Kinsey. Each lost left leg below the knee. Boy, I just hate to see this. There was a funding site, Give Forward, to raise money for surgeries and rehab costs. It raised more than $438,000 of a $500,000 goal. So this is actually serious money for crowdfunding. It's become a means to help out in a crisis. And, they're offering some real-world help, too. A fellow amputee offered via Bucks for Bauman to provide Bauman with free medical supplies. Another Give Forward Command campaign for a longtime Massachusetts resident, Ann and Eric Wally, surpassed its $83,000 goal and weighed $100,000 goal. Now, the problem is, these started out very successfully, but then immediately the fraud kicks in.
Yeah.
Malware was reported on many of these. Many malware sites were set up, highlighting this week's events to try to track people there as bait. And there were around 100 new and potentially sketchy domain names set up to raise funds. So, at this point, if you want to donate money, make certain you do a little bit of verification on the site you're dealing with to make certain that it's valid, because there are fraudsters now kicking up there.
How can you be sure, though?
Well, you can actually, you could try to... I mean, if these are legitimate, there's probably a landline or a phone number or some offline method of verification.
Gotcha.
So I'd recommend using, if there's no offline method of verification, I'd forget it.
Mm-hmm.
But the real one's going to have an offline method of verification, so you can actually do that. But with a little bit of research, you can figure it out. So in the beginning, the fraud wasn't the issue, but now fraud is becoming the issue. Now, the other piece of social media that came out there, talking about social media, Google Person Finder was used.
Yeah, right, exactly. Yeah.
Now, Google Person Finder was set up after the 2010 earthquake in Haiti, and it was activated following this marathon explosion, and it was used to share information about people. So if you were looking for someone, you put in their name and search for it. And if you knew somebody was safe, or if you knew you were safe, you'd put in your name and say, okay, I'm safe, and you put in the data. And so it was just sort of a device to kind of share information. There was also Google Docs was used a lot as kind of a shared document for marathoners stranded in Boston due to flight cancellations. They set on Boston.com set up a Google Docs document where people could express a need for housing, because there was no hotels there available, and guests could make an offer, people who owned a home could make an offer to guests to stay there. So it's another way of social media coming to the forefront. But it was actually quite a big week and a sad week.
Yeah,
but it showed tremendous response and resilience on the part of the folks from Boston, and the police department really did impress me.
That's the thing that I keep seeing when we have these events, is that no matter how much technology you have, it comes down to the people that are using it in order to make it work.
That's right.
It's amazing post 9/11 to see what the federal dollars have gone to by in local areas. Everybody seems to have one of these urban assault police trucks now. Did you see how many of those did you see running around Boston?
They've got a lot of. Probably if you think back on, at an airport, if you leave a suitcase unattended, it's going to be picked up.
Mm-hmm.
Yet the method of operation there was to leave unattended backpacks everywhere.
Right.
So that, in and of itself, was probably bad policy, because it's very difficult to manage every unattended backpack. You really don't know what it is.
Well, that was an issue after the fact, this happened, was that people just ran and dropped stuff. So now the police department is faced with a street that's a crime scene that's littered with bags and backpacks, and nobody knows what is just junk and what could be a potential device.
But the runners would actually pre-position backpacks that they would pick up. So they would actually leave them. They just didn't pick them up.
And, after the fact, I heard a lot of people that were saying that they had left, because you can't run with your cell phone. People were away from their cell phone, so they couldn't let people know that they were okay because they never got to and across the finish line to get back to their backpacks.
Right. Now there is software, and I saw it demonstrated, where it can track a person, and if you walk along and leave an object behind, it will ring a bell. I mean, there is software coming along there. So we may see some more additional software. We'll certainly see, I think, a different type of security on the next Boston Marathon. We got an email from Lauren. Dr. Schertz, I've used Word 2007 for many years, and I believe I'm above average user. Well, okay, I think you probably are too, Lauren. Lauren's a Tech Talk listener. I'd have to agree with that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a tech writer. Today I did several screenshots and pasted them to the document. I've done this a lot, but for some reason, Word has inserted a blank page after my three screenshots, and I can't remove the blank page. I've tried all the typical methods and spent an hour trying to remove this page. If you have any ideas, I'd be most grateful for your help. Best, Lauren. Well, I need probably a few more specifics, but I can give you a couple of ideas. It turns out that Word does have a problem. Like if you insert a table into a Word document, and people have talked about this, there's a paragraph symbol at the end of that table. And if the table exactly fills the page, that paragraph symbol, which is required for the formatting that inserted the table, flips to the next page.
Ah.
So you're stuck with a page after the table, and you can't get rid of it because you can't delete the formatting tab.
Mm-hmm.
Now, here's the trick that people have said works. First of all, you have to go and you have to show your formatting so you can reveal your formatting. You can go to the drop down menu it's really normally a paragraph symbol. You click on that paragraph symbol and it will reveal the formatting. You locate the format symbol or the paragraph symbol after the table, or in this case after your images, and you adjust the font size to 1 point. And you make the paragraph symbol so tiny that it will fit on the page.
Gotcha.
And so that was the only way that people that had this extra page after tables could get rid of it. So that's one idea. The second idea is that it could be that you're just getting an extra page in your image capture, in your image. So you want to make certain that there's not an extra blank graphic at the end of the other pages, because there's nothing that Word's going to be able to fix that. So those are my only two suggestions. And without any more specifics, I can't really suggest anything else. But good question. I suspect that paragraph trick at 1 point font is going to be your trick. We got an email from Ralph. Dear Doc and Jim, what do you think of CloudOn's Office app? I listen to the podcast almost every week. Love the show, Ralph in Reston. Well, Ralph, I do like CloudOn. CloudOn is available for both the iPad and the Android. It provides a fully functioning version of Microsoft Office, and you can save your documents to Google Drive, Dropbox, or Box. You can create, edit, share, Word, Excel, and PowerPoint files, whatever you want. It uses virtualization technology. It's basically thin client technology. You're essentially using a remote copy of CloudOn, of Microsoft Office on CloudOn servers. Now, they're running Microsoft Office, and they simply send the graphics to you. You've got all the features available to you and including creating charts, tracking changes, inserting comments. You can display PowerPoint slides and full presentation. These are basically, it's a full office running in thin client mode. CloudOn even gives you Adobe Readers to support PDF files as well as File Viewer for other files. With Google Drive and Dropbox and Box integration, your Microsoft Office files really don't take up much space on your tablet. Now, currently, CloudOn is free. I'm thinking they've got to pay a licensing fee to Microsoft, you know, when they're running Microsoft Office on their servers. I'm thinking, what kind of business model is that? So I had to do a little research on CloudOn because I said, you know, something doesn't square up here. This is what I found in the small print on CloudOn. CloudOn is completely free, but in the future, after we've hooked you, the service may have tiered pricing where parts of the application are free and other aspects of the application may have a charge. This program is a great option now, especially while it's free, but it's eventually going to cost you. But I'd say right now, it's a deal.
The after we hooked you part was in Dr. Shirt's parentheses.
That's
correct?
Right. That was not on the website. That was my mind. And you know, and the thing is, I could be hooked on CloudOn, to tell you the truth. We got an email from Knock in Ohio. Oh, Knock is one of our regular listeners. Dear Tech Talk, what's your opinion about backing up to cloud services such as Carbonite? Wouldn't it be simpler than backing up to an external hard drive? And also, since I have... since I already have the backup disk for my whole operating system, it's even necessary to back up the operating system at all. Love the show, Knock in Ohio. Well, Knock, that was a great email. I didn't realize you were, you know, so technical with all of this stuff, but you are a Tech Talk listener.
Yes, well, there you go.
Yeah, well, cloud-based backup is fine, but be certain you understand what's being backed up. Cloud-based backup is only going to back up your data files. In fact, it'll back up only the data files. Typically, they're in My Documents. Now, for most people, that's adequate, but it's not backing up your entire computer. It's also going to depend on your internet connection and how much data you can upload, and upload speeds vary depending on what kind of connection you have. To back up an entire computer, one thing that I've discovered is that when you use, for instance, a service like Carbonite, the first time you back up, it takes a long time to do the backup. I use Carbonite for my laptop. The first time I backed up the entire hard drive, which is I got gigabytes of data because I got all the Tech Talk files on there, it actually took 3 days to back it up the first time. Now, I just backed it up unattended, but it took 3 days because it was backing up a huge amount of data. When it was backing up all of these files. Now what it does, it just does incremental backups. I create a new document and it backs it up. Now one thing that's a little bit frustrating, sometimes it backs it up so fast that I can't save the document. Like when I'm working on the podcast XML file, sometimes I'll be, you know, editing the file and I'll try to save it and it will say file sharing error because Carbonite is backing it up as I'm changing the file.
Wow.
And that just really teased me off, to tell you the truth. So now when I'm actively working on something like that and I don't want to have these file sharing errors, I pause Carbonite for about an hour.
Ah.
And then I don't have a problem. Now, if you want to back up your entire computer, you'd want to really use a disk image program. Now, a typical disk image programs cost $50 to $60. Now, the advantage of disk imaging is that, of course, if your entire system crashes, you just simply restore the image and everything's there. All the programs, the configuration, the applications there. You don't have to do anything. So disk imaging is not a bad idea. You're going to spend $50 to $60 for a disk image program. There are four pretty good ones. Acronis True Image is good. Paragon Backup and Recovery is good. Norton Ghost is good. Macrium Reflect is pretty good, and Macrium Reflect has a free version. Now it's what we do, for instance, at Stratford. I mean, we don't use Carbonite. We've got our own basically cloud backup, and we've got distributed hard drives. We do file backups every day, and then we do file backups on a continuing basis, and we store everything multiple locations. Then at the end of the day, we do a complete image backup. So we do a combination of image and file backup. And you really typically want to do both because if you just lose one file, you can go back in and just restore that one file Whereas if you just you only have an image, you got to restore everything just to restore one file. So doing both is probably good. A good compromise, if you really want to be careful, might be to do an image once a month and then do Carbonite for your file backups during the day. We got an email from Hawk in Bowie.
Who is related to Knock in Ohio.
That's right. We got another regular email. I think they must could be communicating. Dear Tech Talk, I get lots of text messages from my family in Ohio.
Yeah. They are communicating.
Yeah. Some of these text messages are private, and I don't want them to show up on the screen of my cell phone, especially when I'm at work. Okay. I don't know what kind of text messages those are, but I'm not going to ask. Okay, what can I do? I'm afraid to put my cell phone down on my desk because somebody might come by and look at what's coming in on my cell phone. Okay, I think you need to keep your family under control.
That's number one.
First of all, you might ask your family to tone down the text messages during working hours. Now, you could also, this is another idea, change your notification settings on your iPhone.
Good
which
point.
Is quite easy. You'll go to settings, click on notifications. So first of all, go down to messages. This is what the go to the messages program under notification, and you'll have a lot of options. If you turn off preview, it doesn't show the text of the message. So you simply turn off preview, and then whatever they're saying, it just says message. It doesn't say what it is. So that might solve your problem. Now, if you don't want any notification to show up, not even that you're getting a message, you can go to the alert style, and you can click none.
Mm-hmm.
For your messages, or you've got two other types of alerts. You can have an alert where it notifies it at the top of the screen, another one in the middle of the screen.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it could be that you want to see the alerts if your phone is open, but if it's in the lock screen, you don't. So if you don't want to see it on the lock screen, you have the option of don't show alerts in the lock screen. So under notifications, you have a lot of control over all of these programs. And what happens is anytime a new application installs, it wants to get all the notifications. So if you're not careful, you're going to have Facebook coming up and flashing and Twitter flashes, and then they start beeping and making all kinds of noise. Quite frankly, I've turned off all the notifications on my phone.
Wow.
It doesn't beep. It doesn't light up. It doesn't do anything. When I want to look at it, I look at it.
Huh.
And that has helped me manage my time so much better because, you know, you're sitting there working and then your phone goes beep, beep, and it starts lighting up, and then it's really hard to not look.
I turn the ringer off if I don't want to be bothered, and I turn it upside down.
Okay, so there you go. Well,
I'm old school, though. I'm low tech.
You're old school. So I've used it with notifications. But I think your real problem, Hawk, is with your family.
Yeah, really.
I think you got to get them under control. We got an email from Philip in Manassas. Dear Tech Talk, I just found out that my computer has a virus. I've got a problem over here. I got the cord in the wheel of the chair.
Cord in your coat, and it's a low tech issue.
Yeah, it's a low tech issue, but I'm going to try to muddle through.
You know how we fix that? We get wireless headphones. That way we can wander around the studio.
That's what we need.
We need wireless
headphones.
Let me work on that.
Yeah, check on that, whether that's in the Tech Talk budget there, you know.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. So moving along.
Okay, this is an email from Philip in Manassas. Dear Tech Talk, I just found out that my computer has a virus. I work in the public school system. I'm constantly using flash drives that contain student work. Can a flash drive, give me a virus? Thanks, Philip in Manassas. Well, actually, flash drives do carry a lot of viruses.
Yeah, sure.
Every time I go to India to visit the campus in India, I've got my computer there. And they're giving me all kinds of documents and everything on flash drives. And I'm telling you, the flash drives on that campus in New Delhi, they are just loaded with viruses. Mm. It is a problem. And viruses, I mean, it's a very typical problem. So what you want to do is there's a feature called auto run in your computer, which, you know, if you put in a CD or a flash drive, it looks around for an executable program and it runs it. Now, that's convenient. Like if you put in a music CD, it just automatically starts playing the music. Or if you put in a DVD, automatically starts playing the movie. Or if you've got a bunch of pictures on it, something, it automatically starts showing the picture. So auto run is convenient, but the problem is the viruses take advantage of the auto run feature. So you stick it in, auto run, runs the execution file, and before you know it, you got a virus on your machine.
Yep.
So I actually turn off auto run. The other thing that I do, you know, you really want to update your antivirus. And so whenever I put a new flash drive into my computer, it immediately scans that flash drive. Now I've got auto execute, auto run turned off. It immediately scans that thumb drive. And I'm constant, when I'm in India, I'm just constantly cleaning those thumb drives of viruses. And but that was a good question, and I'm telling you, you're using thumb drives from students in school. You are virus central.
Yeah,
so you be careful there.
You need a Norton booster shot or something.
That's right.
Those are great emails, Doc.
Yeah, and we love your emails. Send emails to us at techtalk@stratford.edu. We'll cover them on the show, or we'll get back to you some other way. And, of course, I am monitoring the Facebook page. Go to facebook.com/techtalkonline, and I'm going to sit here and watch for your comments real time during the show.
Of course, you can learn everything about this show by going to techtalkonline.com. Learn more about Stratford University by going to stratford.edu. You're listening to Tech Talk, which is heard every Saturday at 9 on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, 820 AM, and 107.7 FM HD2. More Tech Talk right after this.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
Application and software developers shape our world. Those who design and build these systems are the leaders we follow. The School of Computer Information Systems at Stratford University's Tysons Corner or Woodbridge campus offers programs with a real-world, hands-on education. In fact, many of today's Stratford IT grads are working in their chosen field. Make it work for you. Stratford University. Get working. Check us out on the web at stratford.edu. That's stratford.edu. A rewarding future as a holistic caregiver or nurse practitioner. Combining the art of caring with the human science makes nursing today's breakout field. Stratford University's School of Nursing at the Tysons Corner or Woodbridge campus offers a patient-centered approach with valuable core clinical training. Stratford provides a real-world education in nursing. In fact, many of today's Stratford nursing grads are working in their chosen fields. Make it work for you. Get working. Check us out on the web at stratford.edu. That's stratford.edu.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
Welcome back to Tech Talk Radio. We're in the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University talking technology. And now it is time for
Profiles in IT.
Yes, today we're going to feature Claude Elwood Shannon. Claude Elwood Shannon is a mathematician, electronics engineer, and a cryptographer who's also known as the father of information theory.
Uh-huh.
Claude Elwood Shannon was born April 30th, 1916. We're almost up to his birthday in Petoskey, Michigan. Now, the first 16 years of Shannon's life were spent in Gaylord, Michigan, where he attended public school, graduating from Gaylord High School in 1932. Now, when he was in high school, he liked to tinker around. He constructed model airplanes, he made a radio-controlled model boat. He put together a wireless telegraph, and he could communicate to a friend of his about a half mile away. His childhood hero was Thomas Edison.
Mm-hmm.
Who actually, he went back and did sort of a family tree analysis, and he found out that he was a distant cousin of Thomas Edison.
Huh.
Kind of an interesting observation. In 1932, he entered the University of Michigan, and there he learned about a guy by the name of George Boole, who invented Boolean algebra, which was a very important discovery for Claude Shannon. He graduated in 1936 with two bachelor degrees, one in electrical engineering and one in mathematics. Then he went to graduate school at MIT and working on a master's and a PhD in electrical engineering. He was exposed there at MIT to an early analog computer, which was a difference calculator kind of thing. And it was this early analog calculator had you know, had different, you know, relays on it. It was operating in, you know, mechanically with all kinds of relays. And he noticed that Boolean algebra and binary arithmetic could be used to simplify the arrangement of the relays on an analog computer as well as in a call routing switch. This was kind of the beginning of his major insight into concepts that would be a precursor to the development of the CPU, because all of our computers now are basically use Boolean algebra. They just manipulate zeros and ones, and transistors are like relays.
Mm-hmm.
So he was actually laying the foundational framework for digital computers, which is why he's a profile NIT guy. He received that, and he actually wrote a thesis for his master's degree that laid the foundation for the computer, and that was probably one of the most significant master's thesis ever written, because usually people do something significant on their PhD.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he got his PhD. He applied these same techniques to theoretical genetics. There was a guy there that was interested in the genome and, you know, DNA, and could we apply this kind of processing to theoretical genetics? And so he did some pioneering work in theoretical genetics and got his PhD based on that. But it was really his master's thesis that had the biggest impact on computers, not his PhD thesis, not his PhD dissertation. After he got his PhD from MIT in 1940, he got a job at the Institute of Advanced Study at Princeton. This is where, at that time, you know, he was a research fellow. Einstein was there. Alan Turing was there with the Turing machine. And so, you know, all of the big luminaries in physics and engineering were there. So he was able to really collaborate with many people. And a lot of his ideas on computer architecture resonated with the stuff that Alan Turing was doing, that came up with the Turing machine and sort of the construct of a machine that could be constructed that could calculate anything. In 1940, after being at Princeton for a while, not too long, World War II broke out, and he joined Bell Labs during World War II to work on some classified projects, and he was assigned to work on fire control systems and cryptography. In September of 1945, after the war, he prepared a classified memorandum for Bell Labs entitled "The Mathematical Theory of Cryptography," and he observed that analyzing the constructs for being able to encrypt information had a lot of similarities to information theory and how much information could be passed through a channel. So he said his work in cryptography was very important to his theoretical work in information theory, and they were like two peas in a pod, and that working on them together was very helpful. In 1948, he published a two-part paper, "The Mathematical Theory of Communication," which formed the foundation of information theory. So he would calculate how much you'd have a line with a certain bandwidth, how much information could pass down the line, and he would then calculate the theoretical maximum limit of information transfer, and that was the beginning of sort of information theory. His work focused on a problem, how to best encode information that the sender wanted to transmit. Now, in order to handle noise, he developed something called information entropy, which is a measure of uncertainty in the message. And so this whole idea of applying entropy, the statistics of entropy, to information, which is certainly it's not thermal, not like entropy of a thermal system. So he's applying these statistical concepts to information as a measure of uncertainty in the information. It was really pioneering work, and that allowed him to get some fundamental theorems on information theory. He's also credited with the introduction of sampling theory, which allowed you to take a continuous line signal and turn it into a discrete set of samples. And that was critical to the move from analog to digital transmission. See, in the beginning, all phone lines were analog. And he says, well, why don't we sample it at 64,000 times a second, at a sample of 64,000 times a second. And then each time we sample it, we'll digitize that so we can convert an analog system to a digital signal. And no, it really wasn't 60. It was it would generate a bandwidth of one channel of 64 kilobits per second, and so he would actually sample it at a certain rate, and the rate that they would base it was based on the ear. You'd sample it fast enough so the ear couldn't hear the sampling rate. So they did some, and so Bell Labs worked on sampling theory. So almost all of the back end transmission in the phone system is all digital, even though the POTS line that comes into your house is analog. It's converted very quickly to digital using the techniques that Claude Shannon developed. After the breakup of the Bell Lab, then after he left Bell Labs, he moved to MIT to an endowed chair. That was in 1956. After the breakup of Bell Labs, the part of Bell Labs that remained with AT&T was renamed the Shannon Labs in his honor. Now, outside of his academic pursuits, Shannon liked juggling, unicycling, and chess. And in fact, he wrote some programs, some chess programs that you would play, and he developed the Minimax algorithm for trying to calculate the best chess move in the thing and did quite a bit of work on that. He was also a co-inventor of the first wearable computer with Edward Thorpe. And this device was worn so that you could improve your odds while you were gambling. They applied it to roulette. Now, Shannon would go with his wife on weekends to Las Vegas. He'd go with MIT mathematician Ed Thorpe, and Ed would bring his wife. And they would use game theory and card counting in order to shift the odds. And they just cleaned up. They were making a killing there. And there used to be MIT blackjack teams that would go to Vegas and make money.
I'll bet at some point Vegas kind of cut that off.
That's why Vegas is using face recognition technology now.
Really?
Yeah. And so if you actually do that, they're going to put you in their database, and you walk into a casino, they're going to show you the door before you can go to the table. Shannon and Thorpe also applied the same theory, later known as the Kelly criterion, to the stock market with even better results. Get this. This technique was used by Warren Buffett.
No kidding.
So who would have imagined that Claude Shannon would have an impact on, you know, trying to game the gamblers, trying to game the stock market. I really don't, predict the stock market, as well as foundational work in information theory and the transfer of information through a lossy medium, as well as foundation work in the whole development of a computer architecture using Boolean algebra.
So here's a guy who didn't make his money with what it was that he developed, but he used technology to make his money in another way.
Exactly. I had to finally bring it around to the money.
That's pretty amazing.
And so
he'd be almost 100 years old. Is he still with us?
No, he's not with us anymore. I should. Oh no, he could be with us. He ultimately did get Alzheimer's disease. Let me check on the break. I should know that, but I don't.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, we've got a few moments to do that. Well, I hope you're paying attention because, as always, your knowledge can result in free food, but to bring it around there. Playing the pop quiz coming up here in just moments on Tech Talk Radio. Heard on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, 820 AM, 107.7 FM, HD2. Be right back.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
Technology is constantly changing. An effective IT manager must not only understand the possibilities and limitations of the technology, but also the requirements and constraints of the business world. Enhance your career today with a master's degree from Stratford University School of Computer Information Systems. Classes are offered day, evening, and weekends to match your busy schedule and are taught by experienced faculty members with industry experience. Earn your master's degree in as little as 15 months with an accelerated program in software engineering, information systems, information assurance, or telecommunications. Learn more about earning your master's degree from Stratford University at stratford.edu or call 1-800-444-0804. Disclose statements available at stratford.edu/disclosures. Stratford University, 1-800-444-0804.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
It's time for Washington's most popular and longest-running radio game show, the Stratford University Pop Quiz. Now, here's your host and star of our show. No, it's not Gene Rayburn. It's not Alex Trebek. It's not Richard Dawson. It's Dr. Richard Schertz.
Welcome back to the classroom of the airwaves.
Yes.
Yes, indeed.
You always kind of strut your stuff when you say that. I think you're making a point with me.
I just love to do that. Mm. That's right. Well, of course, if it's a classroom, there is going to be an assessment. And we're going to have a pop quiz. If you get the correct answer to the pop quiz, you will get an A for the day, plus two tickets to fine dining at the Escoffier Dining Room. Earlier in the show, I was talking about Claude Elwood Shannon. He was a cryptographer and a mathematician and the father of information theory. But the real thing is, how did he make his money using his theories? Because actually publishing stuff doesn't really bring you a lot of money, especially if you're working for Bell Labs, where everything at Bell Labs at that time had to be open, had to be public domain information, so hard to make money. So how did he make a little bit of bucks from what he did?
I'd like to know when the word assessment replaced the word exam in academia.
Well, it's, you know, I started out with exam, but I thought we had moved to the next level.
Ah, okay. All right.
And so...
Well, to move it along here, you need to get us the answer. We're running short on time. To call us now, you need to call us if you're calling from west of Petoskey, Michigan. It's 877-936-9333. If you're calling east of Reno, Nevada, it's 877-936-9333. And, of course, everybody else can call on the wild card line.
That's
on 877-936-9333. Or...
Yes, if you're calling in from Moscow, Russia, where we've got a team of people there at an education fair this week, you can call in on Skype. Simply connect to Tech Talk Radio 1, and you'll be connected to the studio free of charge.
Very good.
So, earlier in the show, I talked about the website of the week. I briefly mentioned it, the Digital Public Library. Well, after 2.5 years of development, the Digital Public Library of America has finally flipped the switch, and they're on. And they opened up the site. Now, the site, it's dp.la. See, DP for Digital Public, .la, Library of America. DPLA is the website. They collected items from institutions across the country. The library has collected more than 2 million items in a searchable database, and that's just the beginning. In addition to regular searches of the kind you're probably used to, you can view DPLA results as a timeline or a map. It also has an API so developers can build their own tools. DPLA is a beta at this point, and it's going to be adding more and more partner institutions as it builds out the technology. Information portals like DPLA will be an essential public service as people increasingly consume images and text digitally online and actually don't go to just traditional libraries with books. The address, again, is dp.la.
Very good. We actually have somebody on the phone who's ready to play our little game. We're talking now to Jim, who is calling from Bowie, Maryland. Jim, good morning and welcome.
Good morning, Jim.
Jim, you there? Let's try that.
Here.
Jimmy, hi there, Jim. How are you?
Push the right button there and you'd be on there, right?
Exactly, that's right.
That's
it's
right.
Technology.
I think Jim called one time earlier and we pushed the wrong button.
I think probably so.
Earlier in the show, Jim, we were talking about Claude Elwood Shannon. Now, he, of course, father of information theory. But how did he make his real money?
Well, actually, he did it two ways, in Las Vegas and also the stock market.
That is correct.
Very good. Jim, you're the winner.
You got both answers correct.
But you only get one lunch.
Well, he gets
two tickets.
He gets two tickets, but you get an A plus for that, not just an A. So congratulations. Stay on the line and give your name and address and email address to Andrew. We'll get the tickets to you out next week.
Jim, thanks for listening. Thanks for calling. And keep listening to Tech Talk, and we will be right back in just a moment. This is Tech Talk Radio on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, 820 AM, 107.7 FM HD2 and 103.5 FM HD2. More Tech Talk right after this.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
A budget analyst, a vice president of sales. These are today's business leaders, and a degree from Stratford University's Tyson's Corner or Woodbridge campus offers you a powerful path to navigate the corporate world. The School of Business Administration at Stratford University offers both bachelor's and master's degree programs for a real-world education. In fact, many of today's Stratford business grads are working in their chosen fields. Make it work for you. Get working. Check us out on the web at stratford.edu. That's stratford.edu. An executive chef at a trendy restaurant, a hotel general manager at a prestigious resort. These are the high-profile positions in the culinary arts and hospitality management industry. Get working towards your bachelor's or master's degree at Stratford University's Tyson's Corner or Woodbridge campus. In fact, many of today's Stratford culinary arts and hospitality grads are working in their chosen fields. Make it work for you. Get working. Check us out on the web at stratford.edu. That's stratford.edu.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
Welcome to Tech Talk Radio. We're in the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University talking technology. I thought I'd talk about geocaching for a minute.
Yeah, sure.
Right now, that uses GPS to locate hidden treasures. Now, it's been around for a while. I've got a cousin down in North Carolina that does a lot of geocaching.
Really?
She loves to, I mean, it's kind of, they'll just go out for, you know, in the afternoon and just go out and geocache. It's what it is, it's a large-scale, modern-day form of treasure hunting. Now, it's an outdoor activity that uses GPS devices to locate caches anywhere in the world. Now, it's really not a treasure. It might be a keychain or a coin or a matchbox. So the idea is that somebody will locate a cache and they'll put in a small token and they'll have a paper in there so that anytime whoever finds the cache, they put their name and date when they find the cache. And then they'll go to a website, geocaching.com. Geocaching.com, and they'll enter the GPS coordinates of the cache.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all it is. And so you can go to geocaching.com and you can locate geocaches in wherever, you know, around your house. They could be all around wherever you are. And then you simply put in those coordinates in your GPS system. And now that you've got phones, it's very convenient because you can just walk around with them. It doesn't have to be your car. You don't have to get some expensive GPS unit. And then when you find the geocache, you take out the little trinket. And the idea is, if you want to be a good geocacher, you have another trinket you replace it with.
Ah, okay.
See, and so you take it out, and so you might take out a small, you know, piece of costume jewelry or some sort of polished stone or something.
Or a rare coin.
Or a rare coin, and then you could put in something else.
That was a joke.
And then you could put in something else, and then people over time they can have a whole collection of things that they found, and they of course put out their signature token item that they like to leave, and then you sign your name. And so people have fun doing two things. They can either create caches, and then you can also go onto the geocache website and you can log when you found it. So people that hide caches like to do this, and so, you know, they might put them in pipes, they might put them under rocks, you know, anywhere, and it's actually become quite a hobby. Now there are applications which actually go right on either your Android phone or your iPhone. Now geocaching.com has one that they sell for $9.99, but actually there are free applications out there. There's C:Geo and Geo Beagle. Those are two Android apps that are free, and there's an iPhone app that's free called Seek Cache app from iTunes. And so, you know, you can try the free ones, and then if you decide you like geocaching, like my cousin in North Carolina, she just loves it. If you decide you like it, then you could buy one of these for either platform, prices ranging from $1 to $15. And the best ones actually connect directly to the geocaching.com database. So your application knows your location, and then it gives you all the geocaches automatically around you, which is very convenient. So there you go, geocaching, a fun hobby for you techie guys.
Let's take a break. This is Tech Talk Radio on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, 820 AM, 107.7 FM HD2. We'll be back with more Tech Talk right after this.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
Technology is constantly changing. An effective IT manager must not only understand the possibilities and limitations of the technology, but also the requirements and constraints of the business world. Enhance your career today with a master's degree from Stratford University School of Computer Information Systems. Classes are offered day, evening, and weekends to match your busy schedule and are taught by experienced faculty members with industry experience. Earn your master's degree in as little as 15 months with an accelerated program in software engineering, information systems, information assurance, or telecommunications. Learn more about earning your master's degree from Stratford University at stratford.edu or call 1-800-444-0804. Disclose statements available at stratford.edu/disclosures. Stratford University, 1-800-444-0804.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
Welcome back to Tech Talk Radio. We are in the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University talking technology. I was a little disconcerted to read this week that they studied 13 of the most popular off-the-shelf wireless routers and discovered that they could be exploited with moderately skilled hacking skills, and they could be hacked remotely.
Wow.
All 13 routers evaluated can be taken over from a local area network, or with four of those requiring no active management sessions at all. 11 of the 13 can be taken over from a wide area net, and they don't require, and only two of those requires active management session. The report noted that 14 of the devices had critical security vulnerabilities that could be exploited with a remote adversary. So somebody could go to your firewall from outside of your firewall, and they could achieve unauthorized access and remote control of your router. Now, in 2011, one firmware vulnerability affected six hardware manufacturers. And that was taken advantage of by two malicious scripts and 40 malicious DNS servers that scanned 4.5 million Brazilian DSL modems. And they basically embedded programs in those networks with the goal of stealing bank and credit card information. And they did this as an automated way, and they penetrated over 4 million routers.
Wow.
Now, Jack Holcombs, who actually has the company that discovered these vulnerabilities, has notified all the vendors, and they're in the process of receiving common vulnerability and exposure numbers for each of these. Some vendors, Holcombs said, have gotten back to ISA very quickly, and they've already had beta firmware releases and ready to test within 72 hours. Other vendors are escalating this to Tier 1 support. Now, what can you do? First of all, I would check for a firmware upgrade. You can log on to your router. You go to the router, internal router, that's 192.168.1.1 or else 192.168.0.1. They tell you what that is. Log on to it, and there's a place for firmware upgrade. Click on that. You want to upgrade your firmware. You can go to your router manufacturer to see whether firmware is available. Make certain you've changed the password on your router, and I'd also recommend to use WPA2 security protocol rather than WEP. And in the meantime, make certain to have the software firewall on your desktops activated. Well, Tech Talk is over. Listen, we love listening to you, let you listen to the show. We love your emails. Email us at techtalk@stratford.edu and make certain to go to the Stratford website, stratford.edu, and check out those programs and go to techtalkonline.com to download the podcast.
Missed something today? Want to hear it again later on? We're back on the air at 1 o'clock with a replay. See you next week.
This paper. commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program. WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWT FM HD2 Manassas. This is Federal News Radio, on the air at 1500 AM and online at federalnewsradio.com. The only radio station in the world dedicated to serving the federal executive and government contractor. It's our mission to provide news and information that helps federal managers do their job better and help facilitate the business of government. Federal News Radio talks to the people who make government work to build a sense of federal community, discuss best practices, and explore lessons learned. Every weekday from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m., Federal News Radio interviews federal newsmakers one-on-one to explain how their news affects agencies and contractors. The Washington, D.C. home of Navy athletics. Nights and weekends, WFED broadcasts all the action of the Navy midshipmen, George Washington Colonials, American University Eagles, Washington Nationals, and the Washington Capitals. Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.
Sports on your radio today. The Nats take on the Mets today in New York. That starts at 2:30 with the pregame show, 3 o'clock first pitch. And then the Caps are in Canada, in Montreal, to face the Canadiens starting at 6:45. Mostly sunny, breezy today, going up to 65 right now, 40 downtown.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts